Welcome back. Thanks for joining us. Hope you had a good weekend. My name is Henrik, and I'm your host. If you want to hear more of our shows, check out some of our news and see our videos, please go to redeyescreations.com or redeyesradio.net for our websites. We have Patrick Lebrun back on the show today to talk about the French elections just held, Front National, the FN, their results, but also the wider picture in Europe of the rising tide of opposition to the globalists' enforcement of diversity and multiculturalism. Now, Patrick Lebrun is a writer and an activist who has written many articles for Countercurrent. He has extensive experience with the French identitarian movement. He's currently based in the U.S., where he mentors college students who wish to engage in activism. It's a little bit of a longer show today. We have a lot to talk about, and in the second hour, which really is 2 hours long, we are going to examine some of the success of the identitarian movement and also some of the tactics of other groups to fight degeneracy and hit back, and how they have helped to spread the message about our displacement and dispossession. You know, basically all the subjects that isn't addressed by the mainstream media, those they are pretending doesn't exist or isn't happening. So some counterculture dissident activism is coming up in the second, but we'll begin with the election in France, Front National, and go from there. Hey, Patrick, welcome back. Thank you so much for coming on with us again. It's always good to speak with you, and great to have you back.
Great. Thanks for having me.
You bet. So obviously some good news coming out of France about the regional elections that we're going to get into here today. Looking forward more to hear about that. I mean, you're kind of becoming our, I don't know, French correspondent, I guess. Right.
So. Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate that. Yeah. It's, you know, I contacted you before even the first tour saying, let's do a show called Victories in Europe. We're here the day after the second tour happened, and none of the regions are now in the hands of the FN, unfortunately. But I think that nonetheless, you know, there's been a lot of progress made throughout Europe this past year. And even, let's say, behind the numbers of this, you know, the results of this election, I feel like a lot of progress is made, especially in France. And so I think we are a group that's not used to celebrating the victories that we have. We're not used to having victories. So we need to also get used to saying we've won and to celebrate that when it happens.
Yeah, it's true. We're very unaccustomed to that. Just keep spearheading forward. Tell us a bit about the how's the election system work again in France. There's like several passes, right? There's several times people vote, and it seems to be a little bit different than some of the other countries, if I'm correct.
Oh, yeah. It's certainly very different from the American system. You don't walk into the closet and have 20 different choices in front of you like you would with an American-style ballot. You vote on only one level of government at a time. It could be the municipal, it could be the presidential, or one of the regions in between, so, you know, departments, cantons, regions. And when you do go to vote in any of these, there is a little table with these little sheets of paper for each party. You get one envelope, and you can take as many different sheets of paper as you want, because people are very cagey about being public about who they vote for, right? So they'll take a few, they go in behind the curtain, and it just takes a moment. They'll put one in the envelope and close it and put the rest in the trash and then walk out, and they place the envelope into a clear plastic box that the election official is watching. And also, because of this different system, you never have one of these Broward County, Florida sort of debacles where it takes days to count, right?
Right.
You always get the result within an hour, and you never – you know, I've never seen – yeah, I wouldn't say that there's never been any irregularity, but I think it's pretty transparent as far as elections go. And so you also, because you vote for a party, you have the head of a list when it comes to, say, a legislative or any of the regional level elections, or even the municipal. And you vote not just for the head of the list, but however many they can bring in with them based on their proportion of seats that they win. And so each party will propose a list that's divided male-female, and they can choose either a male or a female to be at the head of the list. And nationalists tend to do better, actually, with a female at the head of the list, it seems. And then however many can be brought in along with the leader of that list, they go into power. And so this occurs over two Sundays. The first Sunday, you can have any number of parties running. You know, seven, a dozen, you know, it varies. And then in the second tour, in the case of the regionals, which was this most recent election, you can either have two who arrived to the second tour or even three who arrived in the second tour. And I think even in Corsica, they had four. So it can be a fairly divided field as a result. And so the strategy that goes into doing this is very different from the first-past-the-post strategy, right? Very different from the system where you have a party primary and then you have a general election like in the United States. And also that, you know, that lasts over the course of months for both of those, the primary and general. In this case, there's only 1 week between the first and the second tour, in which there can be a lot of horse trading between the parties that lost, where they decide, are we going to throw in our lots and tell our supporters to support this one group? Will they sweeten the deal by bringing some of our list into their list to run? These are the kind of things that happen in just the day or two following the first tour election, and then they present their new group to the public and run in the second. Or we see something very highly unusual, which is what happened in this last election in Calais and in the southeast, and what's called PACA. It's an acronym for different regions in the southeast, where we had Marine Le Pen, the head of the Front National, their presidential candidate last time and next time, and her niece, Marion Maréchal Le Pen. And that is that the Socialist Party was in third place, and they actually dropped out. They refused to run in the second tour, and they told all of their supporters, and they requested all of the far left as well, to support the center-right party to stop the FN. Also, there was one socialist who was told by his party to drop out in another region, which includes Alsace and parts, you know, Alsace and then all the way west to the region around Paris. And when the socialist, and this is actually the person they told to stop, to quit, was a senator from Moselle. He was also I think he was a secretary of state in the 90s. And he said, no, he was also actually the current regional president. And he refused to drop out. And he was actually kicked out of the Socialist Party for not doing as he was told. However, their strategy worked, and actually this is why the FN, though they were winning in 6 out of the 12 mainland France regions, they did not win any of them in the second tour.
Interesting. Yeah. Would you say generally people, they do show up and have the dedication to keep going back to the voting booth, because we know how apathetic people can be if it's drawn out like this.
Right, right. Well, it's interesting. The turnout was pretty good, and actually I have to say that I was typically as well at 5 o'clock on election day. It's illegal in France to have exit polling where you say, oh, we think this group's ahead or that group's ahead. But at 5 o'clock, they'll give the numbers for turnout. And when I saw that the turnout was so much higher in the second round than the first, I felt very pessimistic, because typically the Front National does not have a lot of votes in reserve, right?
Mm-hmm.
However, I was incorrect. It was not as bad as I imagined. And I only crunched the numbers for Marine Le Pen and for her niece in the southeast. For Marine Le Pen, of the people who did not show up, this is, you know, a rough estimate of the people who did not show up, 36% of them voted for her when they came in the second week. And for her niece, actually just under half voted for her when they came in the second week. So it shows that there's an idea in the media that the people who stay home are all, you know, good, socially acceptable socialists and maybe some communists, maybe some center-rightists. And that the extremists are just so dedicated that every single one of them goes out to vote. So don't be alarmed. You know, it's not that 40% of the youth are FN supporters. It's that when you count all those who stayed at home, only 12% are. This is the thing that they say in the media. It seems right. That this is not the case. It's not the case.
Okay, so there were, you know, the FN was beaten into third place despite, I think it's a leading in about 6 of 13 regions in the first round of voting about a week ago. What does this mean for the FN ahead? And did you expect them to actually get more votes in the wake of the Paris attacks and everything that's been happening in France?
Right. They definitely did. I mean, I think we could say that, you know, the refugee crisis, the terrorist attacks, and also the unemployment problem in France, you know, these are the things that are driving people towards the FN. What's not driving people towards the FN is, say, people reconsidering World War II or reconsidered colonialism or any of these kind of historical problems that were kind of a hobby horse for a lot of the FN activists previous to Marine Le Pen coming and starting her de-demonization strategy. Because they're a party focused on the future and focused on the problems of the local areas where they are running for office, the FN has become a viable party. And in fact, it's the number one party in France in terms of in terms of the votes that they get in the European, the departmental, and the regional elections. It's just that because the socialists and the center-right are willing to put aside all of their supposed convictions about the free market or supporting the working man in order to support globalization and the elite in place, they've managed to elbow the FN from their rightful place in power.
Mm, right. Yeah, very interesting. It's so what do you see ahead here? I don't want to jump ahead too fast here, but obviously the main contention, the main issue here is what the heck do they need to do to win an election and so that the French people can gain control over their country again?
Right, right. You know, the thing is, running a local region, you're very limited in what you can, what's your job description, right? You know, you're running the budgets for high schools. You're controlling non-urban transport, mass transit, or, you know, helping research and higher education institutions coordinate with each other across the region, running apprentice programs, you know, for people who want to have skilled labor jobs. It's not on the regional level where one president of a region is going to save a European majority in France or turn back the hordes who are invading Europe at the moment.
Right, right.
However, so there's something very unique about the French system. I'm not sure if I mentioned this before on Red Ice, but the president of France can do a referendum and basically a plebiscite, go directly to the people with proposed laws. Did I mention this before?
No, go over that again.
Okay, yeah, if Marine Le Pen wins, she will have the legislature cheering for her failure and doing everything they can to make her 5 years a failure. And everything we've seen in their actions leading up to this moment, you know, confirms this, that this is the way they're going to behave. Now, she can go directly to the people, and she's promised to do this on a number of issues, saying, shall we have a freeze on immigration? Should we exit the euro? Should we exit the EU? These kinds of questions, right? And basically put it up to the people to say. And we know that there is the political will in France to have a freeze in immigration. There's even the political will in France to force the remigration of certain groups within France. Now, how that can be done and remain constitutional is hard to say, but a significant portion can be sent back. And in fact, we've already seen Hollande use some of these tools. That is that every person of North African origin, Middle Eastern origin as well, maybe some other places, they can be born in France. They could have never set foot in, say, Algeria, which is the prime suspect here, right, in what's a problem for France.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they will have the citizenship and the passport of Algeria. And in fact, even if they're born in France now, there's no longer the law of the soil, it's the law of the blood. So you get to have a status that allows you to stay in France if you're born there. But at 18, you have to pass a test of citizenship, right? You have to show that you're a decent member of society, these kinds of things. Now, the bar is a bit low on this. If the bar were to be raised, or if it were simply to be if you've had any interaction with the police, a significant number of Algerian youth would not be eligible for French citizenship, right? And it's also possible you can't create people who are stateless persons, but you can remove French citizenship from people who have another citizenship. And like I said, and we know this not thanks to the French government. We know this thanks to the Algerian government. There are almost 7 million Algerians within France. That means that every single one of them is eligible to have their citizenship stripped in France.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Which, you know, it's a good start. But, you know, I think that, you know, a great many of them have an effective dissolution of the country. And, you know, maybe not every single one, but with Algeria in particular. And in fact, if you look at studies at polls of French people, you know, there's a poll of who they would expel from the country, right? And gypsies came in number one, big surprise.
Right, yeah.
I think it was in the 80s, you know, the 80% or maybe even 90% were ready to get rid of them, you know.
Wow.
And then the second one is Algerians. And then, but then if you were to look just at the Harki, which are the Algerians who took the side of France in the Algerian Civil War, then the majority of people want them to stay, right? If you were to look at Moroccans, you know, maybe it's a slight majority wanting them out. And if you look at Tunisians, then actually a majority want them to stay. You know, Tunisians tend to be just better at assimilating, and they value education better. People who've had enough experience, who have lived in these big cities long enough, I think they get a sense of the differences between people by country of origin, and you see that they develop this political will based on these polls. And the referendum process will allow them, if we have Marine Le Pen as president, to get moving on this. Because if we don't get moving on it now, it's hard to see that it can be resolved in any other way through the democratic process, you know.
Right. Well exactly. And because one of the problems is legally that has arisen in France is whether or not French native people, white French people, if they actually exist as a group separate right now. And I told you the story beforehand, but let me read it to the audience so they can get up to speed here as well. It was a French court that recently ruled that, quote, native white French, unquote, do not exist. It goes back to 2010. This rapper, he was joining forces with the sociologist. He released his book in a CD called, Bleep France, basically. And the General Alliance Against Racism and the Respect for French and Christian Identity, a group there, they took them to criminal court in Paris and charged them with public insult and also incitement to discrimination and hatred and violence. So go forward 5 years, 2015 now, and the court finally came to their verdict. And it claimed that white people are not considered native to France under French law. So the two defendants, of course, could not be, you know, found guilty on this charge. But the court said that, quote, the native French as a group does not cover any realty legally, historically, biologically, or sociologically, unquote. And so obviously it ruled that whites the white race is in no way legal component to the quality of France. So then there's something wrong with the law here, obviously.
Deeply wrong, yeah. I mean, this reflects the values of the Republic as it is. And the idea that, and actually if you listen to Manuel Valls and several others as well, they never say the country of France or France. They always say, even the word France, they rarely say. They always say the Republic. And you get the sense that, you know, for them, the Republic began maybe not even in 1792, but with the Third Republic. You know, this is all there is for them within these hexagon-shaped borders, and that the country itself, with its long history, with its people, with its culture, that's all secondary to the paper that rules it. That's a pretty inorganic, ahistorical view that, you know, when it's lasts long enough, will slap hard and fast against the brutal realities that this country will one day face. You know, we'll talk later on in the second hour when we talk about identitarian campaigns, about how they successfully ruined the career of one of these anti-white rappers. There's going to be a lot of great stuff in the second hour that I've never talked about before and English language podcast, and so that's a special treat for the members.
Oh, great. Looking forward to that. Yeah, there's so many good things there to discuss in terms of, you know, strategy and what to do, what has been successful, etc. But so, you know, at the root of this is an issue that, what is there to defend, you know, if they're legally, I mean, it doesn't have to be legally, but let's just be in the confines of the political system right now in terms of what, you know, how can this be changed politically? We're talking about the FN and what they can do and all this stuff. If that will isn't in place, if that legal definition even isn't in place, from a political point of view at this stage, unless you rewrite the law, there isn't really anything you can do, right?
I would disagree. I would say that there are definitely things that can be done. There's a pamphlet that I translated on the 26 laws for remigration that was put out by the Identitarians. And each one of these laws, it conforms with the French Constitution and its human rights protections, and it conforms with the European Commission on Human Rights and the protections that they have in place. And if these are put into place, you know, I don't know how many it would affect, but you know, I think there would be a significant change in the number of non-Europeans on French soil, and certainly a change in the vector, a change in the rate of change will be in the right direction, let's say, of reduction. You know, we don't need to have you know, camps set up and deportation and this kind of thing right at this point. You know, it still can be resolved in a very slow, gradual, legal way. However, I do feel that if Marine Le Pen is not elected in 2017, that the demographic situation could change so drastically between then and 2022 that may be the last chance to peacefully and democratically change what's happening, change the replacement of the white majority in France.
It's a nightmare, Patrick. It's an utter nightmare, and that there is no recognition of what is being done to the native people of Europe. That there's no one that seems to recognize this. I mean, one of the plus sides here is after the refugee crisis here, the invasion. There are some other things happening in the EU. For example, the Schengen zone is kind of close to collapsing. There was a 2-day summit in Brussels just, I think it was last week or the week before that, where they're talking, that the interior ministers are talking about basically the ability of member states in the EU to actually legally suspend the open borders with other members. Right now they're discussing that they'll be able to do this between 6 months up to 2 years, because it's been such an onslaught. It means that this system that's like, you know, kind of enabling all of this to occur might be falling apart because of it. I mean, specifically, it's some of the Eastern European countries that are, you know, pulling hardest in this, thank God. Still, I think even France, even Germany, even you know, Sweden is starting to do certain things now and realizing that they have to close the border. So things are moving a little bit.
They are, and I'd like to return to France maybe a little bit later, but just to go across the you know, the point that I often make to activists is that, you know, elections do matter, and it does matter to get, even if they're civic nationalists, getting them in power does have a positive effect. And, you know, Austria is one of these places building a fence right now. And for about 7 years, the Austrian, the Freedom Party, was part of a coalition government. This was Jörg Haider's party. And sadly, his party had a schism. They fell from power, and then he died in a car wreck soon after. And without the kind of charismatic leader that he was, no one's been able to coalesce the nationalist vote to come back into power. But still, that means that, you know, because the nationalists were in power and then were reelected when the Austrians were given the chance to say, what do you think about how they've been doing, they were reelected. So they're stalking the halls of power, and politicians, they do have a sense for a survival instinct. You know, otherwise they wouldn't have lasted long enough to be in charge. And so, you know, they are building a fence because they know that if they don't, then their careers are not going to last very long. Angela Merkel, on the other hand, does not have to worry about this because there's no democratic route to express, you know, the desire to save Germanness or to save even just a European majority within Germany. She is essentially running without opposition in a hard to believe in the, you know, it's simply not a true democracy, I guess you could say.
Right, exactly. Well, they're an occupied country. America is still occupying Germany.
It's true. And in fact, I don't believe that this has been translated into English yet, but the former head of German military intelligence wrote a tell-all book. This was like, I think, 3 or 4 years ago, in which he talked about how a number of the privileges of the occupying forces remained in place.
Yeah.
And that the fall of the wall was not the kind of magical event that, that you know, I believed it was. I remember watching it and feeling so happy for them to see this happening, a reunification of their country. But it actually was, it coincided with the end of a certain kind of control that the occupying forces had over them, so that they couldn't impose the wall any longer, and that's why it came down. This was, RT covered it in English, but that's, I haven't seen any translations of it into English or French of that book.
But
in Slovenia as well, they're building a fence. Slovenia does not have a nationalist party, but it's one of these, you know, post-communist countries. Also, they went through, luckily they dodged a bullet on the Civil War of Yugoslavia, everyone there rediscovered their national identity in the 90s. And so I think even amongst, say, socialists, you have a stronger sense of the value of what it is to be Slovenian than you'd find in other countries in Western Europe. And so, you know, they're building a fence and abrogating Schengen at times, and at times trying to do it without admitting it. And also, you know, Denmark has been one of the most flagrant in not allowing Schengen to flow. They have regularly set up customs officials on their borders. And this was even done before the so-called Syrian refugee crisis. It was during the African refugee crisis that they did this. And there, the Dansk Volksparti, right, the Danish People's Party, that was a necessary component of right-wing government for many years there. And in fact, in this last election this year, they went from number three to number two. They passed the center-right party to become the second place party.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, just as we see in France now, the center-right and the socialists have an explicit coalition to run the country. Because if it wasn't the case, then the nationalist party would still be a necessary component. But because they see that the nationalists are there ready to take power from them, they have to shut the border. And in fact, and also the people were given a chance to vote on further EU integration on December 3rd. And, you know, it was about other things like policing powers and so on. But you have to imagine that what was really on their minds was the Syrian refugee crisis. What was really on their minds was that they're just another few hours down the road from Belgium, where the nest that the jihadis who attacked France in November were plotting and building weapons and so on. And they did not want to be part of this this catastrophe waiting to happen. And so 53% voted against that. And every time Europeans are given a chance to vote, unless there is intense pressure and crisis, it's quite rare that they go along with what the oligarchs want them to do with EU integration.
Right, exactly. And so it's so bizarre and so strange that still then the majority of people, they don't want it, but they still can't take that step and actually vote for a full-on nationalist party that would deal with the migration question, it seems like. They still fall back. They still vote for the conservatives or the socialists and the status quo. I mean, it's beginning to change. We shouldn't say that nothing's happening, obviously.
Right.
There's tremendous headway. Sweden, too. The Sweden Democrats might become the biggest party now for the next election here.
Right.
So, I mean, that's huge. Despite all the intense demonization and intense, mud flinging on these people who are talking about the nation and the people of the nation, they're gaining power, which obviously means something here.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is going to be a process. And that's the thing, is that people are very slow to change their habits on voting, especially the older they get. And also they're very pragmatic. And if they don't see this crisis touching them directly, they're not ready to act yet. And that's really a sad thing, that they can't look further down the road, or they can't look to, you know, they'll think, oh, that's a problem of the cities. That doesn't touch me. You know, that won't ever affect me. And it's, you know, if anything, these towns that you see where they go from, you know, 500 Germans and suddenly they're at 2,000 population with refugees, supposed refugees staying in them, that this will be the thing that maybe wakes them up. But, I want to say, too, about the Sweden Democrats that, you know, these guys are going to win as a nationalist party with placards with daisies, you know, plastered on them, right? And whereas, like, the Golden Dawn had a golden opportunity to take power, and because they couldn't, you know, I have a lot of nice things to say about the Golden Dawn. I mean, they have the best social programs of any political party in Europe. I mean, frankly, these guys are on the level of Hezbollah, you know, more so than any, you know, political party in Europe in terms of their abilities to deliver for the constituents they hope to represent, and the dedication of their members. But their inability to temper their, you know, their love of certain symbols and of certain gestures, that has been what's kept them out of power. Even when we say they were the second place party at one point, they never broke, I don't think they even broke 15% of the popular vote at any point. Mm. And because they held on so tightly to these symbols that are, you know, detested by the majority of the people, whether we like it or not, that's the case, they're never going to enter into any kind of coalition, and therefore the kind of policies they want to see in place are just not going to happen because of that. And that's a really, I mean, let's, you know, I'll paint my face with daisies if that's what it takes.
I think the logo, the flower that the Sweden Democrat uses is called kidney wort or pennywort in English. if you know what that is, it's a blåsippa, we call it. It's a beautiful little flower that's actually was protected for many years in Sweden, so they have an idea behind why they picked that flower, obviously.
Okay, so that's a national, it's like a national flower, kind of.
In a way, yeah. I mean, it's around in different parts of the world, but yeah, it's kind of special in Sweden in that way, specifically in the Northern Hemisphere, that's where it is. But anyway, yeah, I mean, obviously, despite that, I mean, that now is like a swastika to some people. That symbol is like that. So, what do you do? It's like, what, you know, I understand exactly what you're saying about the Golden Dawn. It's like, why do you have to push it kind of thing?
Yeah.
But at the same time, there's so many people that's going to assume that, you know, that's what's going on anyway.
I guess
strategic, right? It's strategic. You want to try to distance yourself from it and put it in a modern context of a democracy, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think outside of the Swedish media, my guess is that there aren't people who look at this flower and then think of barbed wire fences and barking dogs, right?
Right, exactly.
So,
German,
you know,
shepherds when, and
yeah, exactly. And I mean, you got to reach out to your average Joe, right, to win an election. And so that's the that's the thing. It's like you have to conform to their expectations and tastes in doing so. You know, this is not a new thing. You know, Saul Alinsky, I think he wrote in a preface to one of his books, was, you know, to all the hippies, to cut your hair and put on a tie if you're serious about your values. And so, you know, I guess we can say, you know, put penny warts on your your lapel if you're serious.
Yeah. I guess all this is need to be framed in the times that we are in as well, because I think if things would get extremely bad quickly, people wouldn't have a problem with going from going with the meanderos, which the Greek Golden Dawn is using, as opposed to a penny wort, right? So it's predicated on that issue. How bad is it going to be?
You're right. I mean, I guess that's the thing, is that, you know, either this can be resolved with political parties, or it's going to have to be resolved in the streets, and either through peaceful demonstrations or through violent demonstrations. And it's, you know, it's easy to forget how many of the things that we take for granted, like an 8-hour workday or a weekend of 2 days, that were won with bloody battles in the streets. You know?
Right. Yeah.
And I don't know if that was the case in Sweden, But in France and the United States, you know, it certainly got bloody as people fought for these things that we really take for granted. And so maybe having, you know, a Europe that's for Europeans will be one of those things that our, you know, our great-grandchildren will take for granted, as our great-grandparents did, but that we had to fight in between for.
Well, it has to be. Otherwise, the only option is kind of what happened in Spain and Portugal, where the population were retreating back to the northern territories, and it took them 700 years to get their country back. And it was, and it isn't the same country. Let's face it; it's the demographics is different in Spain than it was. It's not the Visigothic Gallic people there anymore. You know,
right? Yeah, you won't find them dancing the flamenco. Yeah.
Right.
Blonde hair and yeah, it's true. But you know, I don't think it will take that long. I think that, you know, part of the problem then why it took so long was that Europe was in total disarray and there was not a racial identity and there really wasn't even a national identity yet. That came really with the French Revolution. There were just powerful families, tribes, special interests, right? And so it's almost as, you know, comparable to the, let's say, the American Indians, right? The arrival of Europeans. You know, there's no sense of the Amerindian race that could unite them against the invader, right?
Right.
It was just, you know, oh, that tribe over there, they kidnapped my wife and my daughter several years ago, so, you know, What do I have to give you? I'll give you some gold for these fire sticks, and I'll go show these guys what's up, you know.
Right, yeah.
You know, and or help you in your invasion to get back them, or, you know, whatever it was. I mean, that was the mindset. I think now an awakened European consciousness is already happening. And the idea of this is, I guess, what is different about identitarianism from nationalism, is that it's about celebrating local identities while at the same time having this larger racial European identity and a dedication to no more cousins wars and being very clear about who the enemy of the people is.
Right.
And so, I guess we're seeing the same dynamic happening in very many countries. There seem to be, you know, there are a couple lagging behind, notably, you know, Germany, the United Kingdom and the United States, but I guess Canada, there's no nationalist option there either.
Right.
I think that, you know, I don't know about Australia, and it's been quite some time since I've been there, but I feel like there is a strong sense still that, you know, they're a European outpost in on the other side of Asia, and that they need to maintain their majority. Of course, you know, they have their cultural Marxists who are sitting in the ivory towers and owning the media, running some of the parties, but not all of them. But
But
I feel like they have this is my sense, they have a sense of national identity there.
Yeah, they're a little bit more, there's a lot of good people in Australia, we have a lot of listeners from there, a lot of people writing us, they're very concerned, things are changing drastically fast there, and despite that they have dealt with, like, the kind of boat migrations that we're getting from the Mediterranean,
right?
They have a legal, just, you know, policy, which, I mean, it's difficult to get into Australia, but it's still a heck of a lot of people from Asia that are just pouring in there. But they've started to kind of make some movements in the last couple of years here, a little bit of like trying to protest. And I've seen quite a bit of footage of a lot of Australians who want to, you know, keep it theirs, basically. And they're still also, they're a little bit in that position, not that we should play on this, but I'm talking about what the reason, what might be behind why they're having a success. They have a little bit more of a kind of a victim status, right, than, let's say, they're still a victim of the United Kingdom, of their policies, of what they did. Some of them were sent there as, you know, prisoners way, way back. There are some things there that they can glean from to kind of to protect themselves a little bit more. I mean, Britain in that regard is like wide open. It's almost like, due to their success in the past, it's almost like it's lost due to that, in a weird kind of way.
Yeah, I often use as an example for political messaging when I talk about nationalist politics. I use the example of John Howard's re-election. I think it was his first re-election campaign, where they had a huge crisis at that time with this vote migration, like you said. And in just the closing days of the election, there was a boat that came near Australian waters, caught on fire, and many people died. And over the course of 3 days, the story about what happened was changing. You know, first it was they were shot at, and the fire was caused by the National Guard. Then Howard, who was, you know, on the right and had a strong stance on this, started losing. But then the story was they set the fire themselves, and then he started winning. And, you know, and as, you know, little details, but, you know, then it's like, oh, well, how did the Australian Navy or Coast Guard respond to the ones in the water? They did this, no, they did that. And every time that the Navy did not have the moral high ground, Howard was losing. And every time they regained it, he was winning. So people wanted him to be tough on immigration, but they wanted him to accomplish it in a way that was morally acceptable to them. And I think that's really important for, you know, when you're pursuing the political strategy of mass politics, to understand the moral standards that our people have. Actually, Kevin MacDonald has talked a lot about this in his recent work about, you know, what is it that makes white people tick, essentially, is his subject. And he talks about these on your show as well, the Paleolithic Europeans and how they were values-based group and how they were, you know, they were open to others more so than any other group in the world. And that is just another manifestation of what Kevin MacDonald talks about, the same dynamic.
Right, yeah. Frank Salter, same thing. He talks about this. He's from the former Max Planck Institute for Behavioral Physiology. He studied a lot of things related to genetics and these kinds of things. And he's also kind of, you know, describing a situation where the values of us Europeans is not going to change. He's talking about how we have to, we can't go against those. We have to work with them, whatever that means. And yeah. it's at least for now, right? Because things aren't as drastic, at least yet, which would spawn a different kind of reaction. But as things stand right now, the reason why we're in this predicament is because many of us do generally want to help people. That's just what it's like, right? We're compassionate. We're reaching out to other people. Then that we're getting kind of we're giving them our hand and our arm is being ripped off. That's kind of a different, you know, issue that's occurring, but it's something within us that wants us to help other people, basically.
Yeah. I mean, we're not involved in this because we want to, you know, hurt Syrians. However, we also have to realize that there are many people acting in our name, far more powerful than us, who are doing indescribable damage to the Syrian people.
Of course, absolutely.
You know, it's something that's pretty amazing when you think about there was a crisis in the last years of the Reagan administration in the 80s in the United States called the Iran-Contra affair. And I'll just describe that briefly. But, you know, what we have now is something that, you know, the Iran-Contra affair pales in comparison, but it's basically the same thing. That is the president at that time, Ronald Reagan, he wanted to continue his anti-communist policy and also the Monroe Doctrine, by supporting anti-communist forces in Central America to fight communist or pro-Soviet but non-aligned countries, right? And so the Congress said no, right? Well, so now what to do? Then that began – so the Congress controls the purse, as we say, in the United States. The president controls the executive, so he has control of the army and these kinds of things. And so he decided all he has to do is go around their power of the purse to find money elsewhere to do this. And so, you know, part of it was donations from guys like Ross Perot, right, and just like really dedicated and wealthy anti-communist. And part of it was a guy named Oliver North, who was a colonel in the Marines at the time, was at the center of this very elaborate network of selling helicopter parts to Iran in exchange for money to buy small arms to support the Contras fighting against the Nicaraguans, right?
Just an incredible story, that thing. God, such a mess, you know?
it showed it for a moment the deep state of the military-industrial complex showed its face.
Yeah.
Just as it did very briefly during the Watergate hearings, right? And Iran was under embargo, obviously, because the revolution had happened. They'd held American embassy officials and CIA agents hostage, but it also meant, and this is the power that arms dealer nations have, because it meant that all of the incumbent equipment that Iran had that they needed to fight off the Iraqis in the Iran-Iraq war that lasted, I think it was 8 years, right? Whenever a tank broke down or a helicopter broke down, the only place to get those spare parts from was from the same country that sold it to them, the United States, which now had an embargo on them, right? And they were definitely not pro-communist that took over, so they couldn't start, running, Russian equipment. And so they were really in a bind. And so it was a way that, I guess they did some good things as well. They got some American hostages released, even though they're supposed to have a policy of not dealing with hostage takers, not negotiating with hostage takers. They didn't get these guys released thanks to this. But it was a way of subverting the national will, because the national will is supposed to be expressed by Congress. Congress said no, it should have been the end of the story. Now we have, since 2006, the neocons have been out of power, right? They're basically living in the shadows of power, and in these second tier positions like Barbara Victoria Nuland.
Victoria.
I'm thinking Barbara Spector and Victoria.
The monster combined, two-headed beast.
Exactly. Yeah. But the so now I always begin this discussion with folks who get their news from the television. Let's say I say, what was Christopher Stevens doing when he got killed, the ambassador who got killed in Libya? And because everyone wants to talk about Benghazi, right? The certainly Republicans do. But Republicans and Democrats are in agreement about not wanting to talk about what he was doing there. And what he was doing was he was buying weapons caches from senior officers in Gaddafi's army. And these were to be smuggled off to Syria via Turkey.
Yeah.
And basically the local jihadis, let's say the farm team, they wanted to have a crack at jihad. They didn't want to – one, they probably didn't trust that it was going to the bigger jihad. And two, they just wanted to have their local jihad. And so they stopped the deal from happening. And also keep in mind, these are, just as antiquities in Baghdad were, right? These are national goods. This is the part of the even though they're guns, if it's property of the government, this belongs to the people of Libya, not to the officer that Christopher Stevens was there to bribe.
Right.
To buy these from, right?
Yeah.
So the destination of these guns was Syria via Turkey. The American journalist Serena Sim, who worked for Press TV, filmed cooperation between the border guards of Turkey, the army of Turkey, and the Islamic State.
That's right. Yep. They're making sure they're in existence. They're funding it through probably through back ways into NATO and their those interests too,
Yeah. Yeah. Turkey is a NATO member country. And so she was warned by some of her contacts. This is a California girl, right? Lebanese American. I think she may have been Lebanese and Italian, or maybe all Lebanese. Worked for Press TV, and she was warned that her life was in danger. And shortly after, a large diesel truck crashed into her vehicle. Didn't have any license plates. The driver disappeared. And no one knew where the truck came from.
So she was taken out, really? I missed that completely, that story.
Yeah.
I saw the video, I saw, the footage, and so I think even in the comments they're like, you better watch out,
So, yeah, she received specific warnings about Turkish intelligence, and then she died in these bizarre circumstances shortly thereafter.
Yeah.
And so this is, I have to say that I seriously doubt that an American journalist, even though she was working for Press TV, I seriously doubt that she would be killed by the Turkish intelligence service without a green light from the American embassy in Turkey.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I seriously doubt this. But that's just speculation. But, I'm also going back to what we know. I believe it was David Ignatius with the Washington Post then. So we talked about logistics and weapons, right? David Ignatius of the Washington Post, he wrote about jihad training camps the CIA was running in Jordan. And he wrote that perhaps 40, perhaps 60% of these guys went on to fight with the Al-Qaeda-affiliated Nusra Front and with Islamic State. And the reaction of Congress after he did this was to double and triple the size of this training program. Right? This is after this Washington, you know, I'm not talking about, you know, Infowars.com here. I'm talking about the Washington Post, right?
Right.
And so this is the newspaper that everybody in Washington, D.C. reads in the morning, and these congressmen get this news, and they increase the size of the program, which makes you wonder, you know, normally when there's a scandal, you don't increase, you don't feed the scandal, right, with more
right.
money
right.
and trainings, right? So then, okay, so we've talked about training and we've talked about guns and the logistics of getting them there. And then finally, there's just simply the money. And in fact, these guys are incredibly professional. They actually produce a, I would say, a Fortune 500 quality annual report. I don't know if probably maybe some of our listeners have seen the annual report that the Islamic State produces, but they have these, you know, pie charts of where their funds come from. Split up, and, you know, from what kind of sources, how they spend them, and what areas they're focusing on, and education, and food programs, and weapons, and so on, and reports on how successful their different attacks are, and so on. And a good part of this, and we know this thanks to Robert Fisk and several others, and you know, I'm mentioning, you know, a lot of journalists who are actually Jewish themselves, you know, and they are exposing this. And this is the Saudi billionaires funneling money into the Islamic State, right? And so, you know, I only say that because I want to say this is not, you know, Jeff Rentz that I got this from. This is, you know, Robert Fisk that I got this from. And so, you know, this the data is all there in very normal mainstream sources. And it's just not going to be on television. It's not
exactly. It's there. If you want to find out, you can. But it's just not the story that's like circulated over and over and over again and picked up and yeah. So everybody knows it. But it's still white, you know, right then and there. But look at the oil deal between, you know, Turkey and ISIS, the son of Erdogan dealing with ISIS and making sure that the funds is back and forth and whatever. It's out there in the open. And yet it's not like, you know, the story that's like, you know, people are aware of.
Right, and now to finish the nefarious web, you know, so, okay, they've got their guns, they got the guns delivered, they got their money, and they got their training. Now what happens when they get hurt? So if you're in the south of Syria, when you get injured, and this was actually filmed by Vice TV, you will be evacuated by the Israeli military into Israel, and you will be in an Israeli hospital to convalesce, get healed, and presumably go back to fight another day.
Yep. That's
this,
right.
That was an amazing video that they have. I think anyone who's interested can go on Vice TV's YouTube page and see this, where they and Israelis, it's interesting, too. They try to pass it off as just they are so humanitarian and open-minded that even the jihadi, when he's hurt, he deserves medical care.
Right, but we won't open our borders and let any refugees into our country. but we're so helpful that we'll help ISIS, which is driving the refugee crisis into European countries. Right. So yeah,
it is. Yeah.
Wow.
And their dream is to be surrounded by rubble and broken states.
Exactly. And yeah.
They want Assad to fall, and this is why they're doing this. And this is why, you know, behind closed doors, Israel and Saudi Arabia are bosom buddies. Which is hard to imagine. I think if you told a lot of people this 20 years ago that Israeli policy and Saudi policy would be indistinguishable at one point vis-a-vis Assad.
Mm.
They wouldn't believe you, but that's the case that we find ourselves in today.
Yeah.
So, you know,
yeah.
And all of this is occurring under the protective umbrella of the U.S. and NATO. And so, you know, I can understand to a certain extent the anger that they have, the anger they have towards our people. And the responsible thing for us to do is to oust these elites that we have occupying the seats of power right now. You know, we've gone over some of the ways that this can happen in a democratic way, how the pressure can be put on them in European countries. I have to say, though, in places where the democratic route is not open, to quote John F. Kennedy, where reform for democratic reform is not possible, violent revolution becomes inevitable.
Yeah,
and right. I think that's the – I don't think we're there yet. You know, France, I believe, has 17 months to go to determine if we can resolve this peacefully and democratically. And if it doesn't happen then, I don't see how any other way it can happen. You know, Manuel Valls, the current prime minister, he was accused not so long ago by one of Mitterrand's ministers of being under the influence of his wife. And this guy, you know, the guy who said this, he's like in his 90s, so he doesn't care anymore. He's just gonna say whatever comes to his mind. You know,
right.
What it feels like.
Yeah.
And what he was referring to is that Manuel Valls has a Jewish Zionist wife. And that Manuel Valls, when he's been really at the forefront of going after Dieudonné, the comedian in France, who is really, I think, amazing comedian. He's really a funny guy, and he's incredibly brave. And he relentlessly goes after this, you know, the Zionist lobby, if you will, and Jewish power. And it's very, very dangerous game that he's playing. He's actually, you know, he's been attacked. You know, I think what happened actually is he made one joke on television once, and then he was barred from television. He's, you know, he was treated like this was different than any other thing. You know, you can make fun of anybody, but in this case, it was he wore like a ski mask, and he had little you know, curly side locks and a kippa on the top, you know, a yarmulke on the top of his ski mask, and he did like you know, like a 70s style terrorist talk to a camera, you know, like these are our demands and so on. And he was a West Bank terrorist, right? And he had the whole panel of this talk show in stitches, you know. And yet the next day they did a huge apology, and the host, who was on camera, you know, laughing to the point of tears, was saying, oh, you know, we're so sorry to our viewers that they'd see this. And Dieudonné was invited back to a talk show to talk about this. And actually someone has taken two clips, one with the same host and an Arab, I guess he's a rapper or something, talking about Charlie Hebdo before the attacks happened, you know, talking about the caricatures of Muhammad.
Mm-hmm.
And then him interviewing Dieudonné. And it's almost the exact same words, but just reversed.
Right.
Dieudonné is making the argument of, you know, okay, we should, you know, be able to laugh at anything. And then the next time is the host making that argument to the caricaturist, you know. But, you know, and shortly thereafter, you know, Dieudonné was with his kids in a park in Paris, and he was physically attacked. And I think, you know, I can understand that this. I think it's just like a normal, if you're a masculine man, you know, your normal response is to elevate, you know, and not, you know, lower your level of vigilance and anger, right?
Right.
And that's what I think of exactly what has happened. And every time they try to turn up the heat on him or attack him more, it was at the beginning of this year, in fact, that they invaded his house. And at, I think it was 6 a.m. or 5:30 a.m., kicked his kids out of their rooms, started going through their mattresses and everything, and, you know, seeking, you know, hidden cash that he has, you know, because, you know, basically they're doing an audit of him. And I guess this happens in an audit if you pissed off the prime minister and the Jewish lobby. You know?
Oh, man. Yeah.
And it's, you know, actually, you know, maybe we could, you know, just talk about his year a little bit. You know, he was, after the attacks, the Charlie Hebdo attacks, he had this pretty bizarre statement he made on Facebook. But I, you know, after I think he meant to be to provoke, and he meant to show, as he always does in his comedy, the double standards of the system. You know, he said that I feel like Charlie Coulibaly, right? And Coulibaly was the name of the guy who took the Kosher Market hostage.
Mm-hmm, right.
And Charlie, like, just to be Charlie, like Charlie Hebdo, right? And he was brought to court. He was threatened with 4 months in jail. They slowed down the process. I think he might have – they might have threatened him with more. I think in the end now he's got 4 months suspended sentence. So it could either be that if he's charged with the same crime, apology for terrorism, right, that he would go to jail for 4 months. Or maybe it's any crime, then he'll go to jail for 4 months and then pay thousands of dollars. And he's paid – tens of thousands,
right, even
over $100,000. He had to pay $22,500 to Patrick Cohen, who's a singer, because he made a joke about him in one of his shows. He's paid, it's pretty amazing. I went to see his show over the summer, and he begins his show with a, in this particular show, it was La Bête Immonde, which is like the incredible beast, I guess you say, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he's like almost like what's that huge gorilla in who goes to New York? The
King Kong or something?
King Kong, you got it. So he's like chained down to these huge cement blocks, and he's like screaming and stuff, you know. And then he breaks out, and then he grabs this automatic weapon, and he starts pretending to shoot it, right? And then he points out, like, okay, this is a weapon that's made in Bourges, which is, you know, like an hour and a half, 2 hours south of Paris. It's made by, this company. And this company, is majority owned by the state of France, right? And this is an automatic rifle, right? And, you know, earlier this year I made this joke, and I was fined by the judge because of my words were a attack on the dignity of humanity, right? And so he points out, like, okay, so the state that makes automatic rifles and sells them around the world has told me that my joke is an attack on the dignity of humanity.
Right. That's right.
It's like, okay, hold on now. But, I think this year alone, I'm trying to just count up in my head as I look at this, it might have been up to $50,000, and I'm sure there's some reserve that they could charge him with. So, he had another. I would recommend anybody to watch his jokes. If you speak French, even if you don't, I think his show Mahmoud was translated in English, and I think most of the jokes translate pretty well.
Mm-hmm. Right,
it's worthwhile. But his effect, I think, on – and it's kind of ironic. You know, we're talking about a man with a Cameroon father and a mother from Brittany. So we're talking about a black man here. That he has a role to play in the defense of a Europe for Europeans.
Right, yeah.
And this is what that is, and that is that he has basically undone the – Black Jewish alliance that still remains so powerful in the United States, that, you know, their ability to, instrumentalize, to, you know, use the, black population in the United States to their own ends. It's, it almost seems like it's, child's play for them. And I think they had the same hopes the organized Jewish community did for France, for other countries in Europe. And thanks to this, thanks to Dieudonné, I think that's simply not possible. And I think that also if Marine Le Pen wins, it will be in the next election. We can talk a little bit if you'd like about the specifics of it. And in fact, if on Countercurrents, I did a very detailed analysis. So if anyone's really interested in the numbers behind the race and a kind of, a granular political analysis of the party and of the last race and of the presidential race coming up, I recommend listening to the Countercurrents interview. But if Marine Le Pen wins this next election, it will be because many, many, many black and Arab youth stayed home during the second tour and didn't vote for a party because they didn't see they saw through the lies, essentially. They saw through the lies of the globalist elites, through the lies of the billionaires who run these parties.
Mm-hmm.
Who will basically pander to them and put up, you know, these pantomime Arabs, pantomime blacks in representative ministerial positions to make it seem like they are arriving in power. They've seen through that game and that they're just not going to play. They're going to stay home. And when they stay home, that's one of the many things that has to happen in order for Marine Le Pen to win the general election.
Yeah, tell us, we're going to, end the first hour here in a little bit, and what's going to happen election or with the political system in France now in terms of who's going to run things? Is Hollande still in there? Is the socialists continuing their majority? How are things changing now?
The legislature and the presidency are still in the hands of the socialists. And this will be the case until May of 2017. That's the next presidential election. And so what's interesting is that in the presidential election last time, Marine Le Pen got about 6 million votes. They got about 6 million votes again in the departmentals and 6 million again this time around. But you have to see there's a drop in voter participation overall in the country, right? So they're actually gaining quite a bit in proportion. So when she won in the presidential election, that was out of a total of 36 million that she got 6 million. This time around.
Oh, 6 million.
Yeah, yeah. And three times 6 million. I think Mark Passio needs to step in and tell us what this is.
Right, exactly.
But so 6 million, again, now out of 22 million. So that means that there are 14 million French who stayed home this time, who have 17 months before they go to the polls and decide who should be their president.
Mm.
And Marine Le Pen only needs about 3, maybe 5 million of them to add to her current supporters. So that's very doable, right? That could be as low as 20% and as high as one-third. And when I talked about earlier their votes in reserve, the people who stayed home in the first tour and voted in the second tour for Marine Le Pen, that was 36%. So we're right there in that, you know, that's definitely doable for her to win the first round to just convince, you know, 3 to 5 million more people. What will also have to happen is that we need to see a left that's united and a right that's divided. Last time around, there was the Front de Gauche, which is Jean-Luc Mélenchon, who is kind of he eventually partnered with the Communist Party. He's a former Socialist Party member, and he is much stronger in his economic anti-liberalism, as they say in Europe, you know, his socialist approach, stronger than the Socialist Party. But his real bread and butter, this guy, this real, like, the thing he wants to talk about every time he's in front of a microphone is anti-racism. And he got 11% the last presidential election. But he's actually dropped out of the party because it's been an utter failure. It was put forward with the idea that, you know, you'd have these two top-tier parties, the PS and the center-right, the Socialist and the center-right party, which is now called Les Républicains, right? And that you'd have a second-tier party where they can kind of, you know, where the shadow self of Marine Le Pen would be Jean-Luc Mélenchon, and they could battle it out together on the second tier. What's the case is in fact, that Marine Le Pen is in the same class as the Socialist Party and the center-right party. Jean-Luc Mélenchon failed in this role of being a foil to Marine Le Pen, and he basically quit, being a public advocate for this this party, though he told them that he'd be glad to come back and be their presidential candidate, which is kind of a jerk thing to do, I think. You know?
Right.
I got better things to do for the next 2 years, but you want me to be your presidential candidate, I'm glad to come back and run your party for you.
Yeah.
You know? But his party got 6.6% in the Paris area and 7% in Normandy, and everywhere else in France they got less than 5%. So I think – and also Jean-Luc Mélenchon, frankly, is the only charismatic person in that party. And so it's really unlikely that they will be a force to be reckoned with in 17 months in the first round of the presidential elections. On the right, I don't know if the centrist is going to run again, who has more of a center-right appeal. He ran last time. And for the center-right party, Sarkozy's party, I believe it's the first time in their history they'll have a primary. Primaries are not really a French thing. I think the very first one that was ever done was either the one that chose Hollande this last time or the previous one where his ex-wife was chosen, his then-wife was chosen, Ségolène Royal. But so there are a few people who have already announced, and it's possible that there's one guy in the party who was formerly a prime minister who has since been sidelined, who may have been plotting the downfall of Sarkozy to take his place, and who is definitely, though he's never proposed aligning with the FN, 40% of his party is in favor of making coalitions with the FN, but not a single leader in the party is in favor of it. He has softened the approach to the FN, certainly in comparison to the others running the party. And, you know, like I said, Sarkozy has not proposed himself yet to run. He very likely would win if he were to propose himself. There's Alain Juppé, who is a former, or I should say he was charged with white-collar crime. Whether he continues to commit white-collar crimes, we don't know. And then there's, of course, the failed presidential candidate for Paris, Nathalie Kouskou-Moizé, who is a spokesperson for Sarkozy and the number two official in the party, and who just happens to be Jewish. And frankly, if she were to win, or if Alain Juppé could be difficult to beat, but if she were to win, or Sarkozy were to win, I can imagine François Fillon running on his own ticket and really dividing the right. But it's still possible. It's still possible that it could be, in order for Marine Le Pen to win, it has to be her against the center-left. That seems to be clear. And it's still possible that the Socialist Party could beat the center-right party. And in fact, with every attack, Hollande's popularity goes up.
Right.
Mm-hmm. He's now at just around 50% for the first time in his mandate as president. So that's basically the horse race there, I guess you could say on that. But I think it's definitely not a done deal for the FN. A lot of things have to fall just right in their favor. And, you know, so far, maybe that's the case. You know, it would have been great to have a region to point to where you could say, look, this is how the FN runs things. Because, imagine if he took any, random person off the streets and took them to a nationalist meeting that you've attended, and you said to this person, everyone here wants to take over running your water, street repair, and taking out the trash. What do you think? I think they might have a nervous look come over their face.
Right.
Because they're very, people are very pragmatic, right? And they want to see that you've proven yourself in government. You're capable of governing, even on a smaller level, before they'll let you run their home country. This is a very normal thing. So
yeah, of course.
It's harder to run when you just simply don't have a record of accomplishments. You only have ideas. And sadly, that'll be the position the FN is in. However, that also means that the opposition will be running against a ghost, right? And this time around, I mean, there were constant references to World War II once again.
Really?
There was even...
of course. I mean, that's what they do. They use that every time, you know? So.
Yeah, well, they've got nothing else to say, you know?
Right.
They are run out of arguments. So they can only say 80 years ago or 70 years ago, really crappy stuff happened, and you guys are just like them, and it's going to happen again if you win. You know, it's like if you run the budget of the high schools, then we're going to have camps and, people being starved to death and so on.
Right? Absolutely, yeah.
There was a debate between the niece of Marine Le Pen and the governor – the president of now of the regional council. He won the election against her, and he was the mayor of Nice. And he produced a picture on the television. He held it up, and it was a printout from the computer of a guy with a shaved head and a bomber jacket doing a Roman salute, right?
Yeah.
And then next to it, there was an arrow pointing to him, and it said Philippe Vaudon. And now there's one problem. Like, it wasn't Philippe Vandon. It was Philippe Vandon. I should explain. Philippe Vandon is a guy who was the leader of the Nice Identitarians. He's been a very regular, a constant public face, for the identitarian movement. And he's left it because you have to be part of the FN. He left the movement. And he's on the list for down the list of Marie-Michel Le Pen's. And so he produces this, and she's like, "That's not him. What are you talking about?" Unfortunately, and it also is like, it's really obviously not him, because unless Philippe Vandon lost 150 pounds and shaved his beard, it's not the same guy, right? I mean, it's like really obvious not him, right?
Yeah.
So there was that. There was Manuel Valls said that the vote for the FN was. The people who vote for the FN want civil war, and they're going to bring civil war to France. This is the prime minister of the country, right? Saying, and keep in mind also, he is addressing the 40% of the electorate in the north, the 40% of the electorate in, or 45% of the electorate in the southeast. Almost 30% of the electorate overall in the country. That these 30% of the people want civil war. That they are a threat to the nation, when in fact I think that you would agree, I would agree, our listeners would agree that those who are bringing civil war to Europe would be the very powers that Manuel Valls, the prime minister, represents. That is,
that's
the
correct
community, the globalist oligarchs, the people who are leaving Europe with the door wide open to jihadists, to invaders, to what have you.
It's amazing, In Norway, let's run this by quick, and then we'll take a break here shortly. But Norway, hundreds of these so-called refugees were like, as they were crossing over to the border, there's been an explosion apparently into Norway, probably crossing in obviously from Sweden then, since they have open policy and the border is very loose between Sweden and Norway. So despite that they're not under the same, kind of European Union framework, if you will,
right. Right.
They've still managed to get in there, right? So police have been stopping people. They're searching luggage, mobile phones, stuff like that, belonging to these migrants. And police have logged hundreds of photos of ISIS flags, beheadings, videos of executions, brutal punishments, images of, people holding up severed heads and stuff like this. And it's like, this is reported in the mainstream Norwegian press. We just linked up the story today. And it's just like, what will it take for people to like realize what a security risk this is? Even if we go through all the stuff that you mentioned about ISIS, because some people take that as evidence. See, it's funded by the West. So it's not real, in that way. But it's like real people.
It's still real, yeah.
Are attracted to it. Exactly. I mean, the danger is there, whether it's a paid off mercenary army or whether it's a truly ideological. Driven group, the danger is the same to every man in Europe, So it's insane. I mean, I wonder what it will take for people to wake up to this.
Yeah, I think it's going to take, sadly, a lot more attacks like we saw in Paris. And you're absolutely right. I mean, you can try to, there's a word used in the United States for this, astroturfing, I guess you could astroturf on the international level and try to buy, mercenary armies or whatever. But, there has to be someone willing to pull the trigger. There has to be someone willing to cut off the head. And the sad thing is, amongst the Muslims of the world, in particular the Arab world, there are a lot of guys lining up to do this.
Yep.
And that's just something that we have to take very seriously. And also, I think we need to also, I hear in my own, political family, if you will, we talk about the need for more traditionalism for us. And then some will say, well, we should also support traditionalism for them. I'd say we should be, supporting those who are fighting for secularism and transparency in these countries. There really are people who want this to come to the Arab world. And there was a brief flowering of that in the Arab Spring. And unfortunately, the powers that be. Didn't want that to happen, and very quickly diverted that energy to the Muslim Brotherhood.
Yeah, it's true. All right, well, Patrick, let's take a break here and then continue talking more about the identitarians and also more of the positive things that's been happening. A little bit of a review, if you will. But do let us know if there's anything you want to give out in terms of websites or anything you want to plug for people so they can find out some more about your work.
Yeah, if people want a more in-depth look at the election that just happened and at the election to come, there and at just understanding the FN, there will be a interview that I just recorded today with Greg Johnson at Countercurrents. That's counter-currents.com. And I guess, Christmas is coming up. And if anyone hasn't thought of something to get for Christmas, they should go to Lana's Llama. What's the website for that again?
Yeah, that's right, lanaslama.com. Yeah, Lana's clothing website, yeah.
Yeah, they should go there to get their Christmas presents. Is there still a very generous discount announced for Red X Radio members. Is that still in force?
That's still there, yeah. That's right, 25% off. So.
Very, very generous. And so, yeah, I would hope that, we need to create our own mutual support networks, whether formal or informal, and, this can be one step towards that. And I'd say once again, everyone out there, there's something you can do in your local area. And some of you, the democratic route is open. I think if you're in Germany, it seems that, maybe Pegida is something that you can do. There are others, and of course you have to be very careful about this. There are others who have taken direct action in their towns and villages when the government has set up buildings to welcome people. There's been direct action against these, and of course these are empty buildings. But I think everyone has their own level of engagement that they're willing to do, a level of risk they're willing to take, and their own different opportunities based on where they're at, but I think everyone has to act who's within the sound of our voices, because, nothing less than the survival of our race and of a living space that we can call our own is at stake here.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. Well, thank you, Patrick. I know Lana will be very happy you mentioned that as well. We'll take a short break here, ladies and gentlemen. Join us in the second hour. We'll be right back. Stay tuned, ladies and gentlemen, in the next hour. Well, actually, we continue for another 2 hours, a longer members segment. But in the next segment, we will get an insight into the activism of successful groups, including the identitarian movement in France. wide range of tactics, actions, and ways to spread the message is coming up. You know, Patrick's really tuned in, has a finger on the pulse of things that has worked and hasn't worked in Europe, so this is going to be really interesting to hear more about this. As you know, if you're a regular listener, the first hour of this show is always for free, sometimes both. We spare you from commercial interruptions, and we offer the second hour of our programs for our subscribers. We also have older shows in full that we permanently archive on the members' website. I wanted to let you know that in about a week from now, we're going to be nudging up the membership prices a little bit. I mentioned this in the last couple of broadcasts, but in case you missed it, you know, we've been going for a decade now almost with the same membership prices and, of course, not adjusting for the drop of the euro. And I wish we were in a world where people would actually press for lower prices than for higher wages. That way, all the happy merchants out there are basically just able to raise the prices and hence inflate our currencies. So you pay more for less, but sanity, as you know, doesn't rule our times. So I just wanted to let you know about that, so that if you've been thinking about signing up, do that now before we nudge up the price a little bit. I also wanted to mention that if you have a recurring membership, one that auto-renews, this will not change for you, obviously. We can't begin to charge you more for this in the middle of it. So you'll be paying the same price, so that will remain the same. Don't worry about it. This will only be for new members that are coming in. So, you know, we have one-time payments from 3 months up to 2 years available. And, of course, we also have a recurring three-month subscription. So, if you ask me, if you want a good deal right now, access to over 1,000 radio shows, interviews on a ton of different topics, and video specials, inside episodes, films, and, of course, an archive that's growing each week, then sign up for a three-month recurring subscription now. And that way you get the best deal and you'll keep paying the lower prices as well. This is a recommendation to you who might have been listening for a long time and not yet subscribed, but been thinking about doing it. Definitely do it now. And it's never a bad time, of course, to support us and what we do as well. So if you want to find out more, the website is redicemembers.com. Go there to sign up and tune in. You can stream or download. We have RSS feeds with all our shows in them as well, divided up by year, so it's really easy to get the show on your mobile device with a podcast app or a podcatcher. But much more is coming up, so please join us, ladies and gentlemen. Another 2 hours with Patrick LeBrun on tactics and activism. We will see you on the other side of the break.